Our third case for this morning is Hill against Werlinger, 11-1533. And when you're ready, Mr. Steinecke, we'll hear from you.
May it please the Court. The question in this case is whether Illinois' simple battery statute has as an element the use of violent force as defined by the U.S. Supreme Court in Johnson versus U.S. Put another way, can a defendant commit an aggravated battery under Illinois' simple battery statute without using violent force?
Are we clear that we're under subsection Romanet 1 as opposed to 2? Under the Armed Career Criminal Act?
Yes, Your Honor. The government makes the argument that it should be...
They suggest it may be the residual clause.
Right.
Should be Romanet 2. But you're saying, no, it's not. And why is that? What do we have from the record that tells us this?
Well, I think the holding in Begay... teaches that in order for a case to be decided under the residual clause, the offense has to be of the like and kind of the enumerated offenses in Romanet 2. The offense in this case is essentially a misdemeanor battery elevated to an aggravated battery with a nonviolent offender. So it's nothing like the enumerated offenses, arson, etc., in the statute.
Well, essentially, I thought you were making a simpler argument, which is that you are discussing the element. I mean, so little Roman 1 is about certain offenses with an element that is identified in the statute, and you're focusing in on the element of physical force, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And just to complete the circle on that point, to the extent we were applying the residual clause in a case like this, it would swallow up Romanet 1. So I think this is clearly a physical force clause case.
So isn't your biggest problem that of persuading this court that we've misread Johnson in such cases as De Leon, Castellanos, and a couple of others?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
We have already thought about Johnson, and the problem, you know, with evaluating degrees of force is that it becomes extremely arbitrary. There's no doubt that there's a battery that took place in that 1993 conviction. I guess it was 92 events, 93 conviction. He whacks the public defender down in the well of the court. I understand that it's a battery in a public place that makes it aggravated, but how is that not enough force to trigger subpart 1,
I guess,
even after Johnson?
My first response to that point is, although I can't defend what's in the record with regard to what Mr. Hill allegedly did, we aren't here to consider his actual conduct.
I'm not asking you to endorse what he did.
Okay.
Don't worry.
But under the categorical approach, our focus has to be on the elements of the crime, not what he allegedly did or didn't do that day.
The categorical approach only comes into play, or mostly comes into play, in a residual clause case. We're already focusing on the elements by virtue of this being a Romanet 1 case and not a Romanet 2 case, not a residual clause case.
Fair enough. So if we focus on the elements, and with regard to the question you asked, Your Honor, on the cases that this court has decided with regard to the elements, our position is that those cases didn't squarely address the question that's left open in the Johnson decision, and that is, what amount of force beyond a mere touching is sufficient to meet the definition of violent force as set forth by the U.S. Supreme Court in that case? I don't think that those three decisions that you cited address the argument we've raised here, and that is that a simple battery under Illinois law is not a forcible felony. I don't think those cases address the argument we made under the rule of lenity. I think Your Honor just called the decision of whether or not force is sufficient enough to satisfy the ACCA arbitrary. And if that's true...
I think I said that, actually. I just said that there's a continuum, and the Supreme Court, certainly in Johnson, holds that not every poke that might count as a battery under the common law qualifies for the language of the statute in Romanet 1. They go on and discuss that the word violent connotes substantial degree of force. And so I guess there are two problems for you. One of them is how one teases out of Johnson and the statutory language how much force is enough. And the second is the one to which Judge Sykes just alluded, which is whether in the Romanet 1 context we can look at the underlying documents, such as the information and so on, or the indictment, and see what happened.
Well, I think as to the second point, we can only use, under the modified categorical approach, the underlying charging documents to determine which provision of the battery statute Mr. Hill was charged under.
But were a residual clause case, that would be absolutely right. But are we so limited when we look at the elements part of the statute?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So you would say, I'm just trying to understand your argument, you would say that when we look at elements, the element itself has to call for some form of enhanced force.
The degree of violence as defined by the U.S. Supreme Court in Johnson, yes, Your Honor. Hypothetically speaking, and we give this hypothetical in our brief, under the Illinois simple battery statute, one could be convicted for squeezing a cab driver's arm, causing a temporary bruise, which, under the state of the law currently, would be enough to qualify that offender for an ACCA enhancement. So I think the question is, we know from Johnson that a touching is not sufficient. What if it's just to the other side of a touching? What happens then? That's the open question.
We've said in at least three cases that simple battery causing bodily harm, any degree of bodily harm, is sufficient to satisfy the elemental analysis of physical force. And that's consistent with what Johnson said about battery schemes that require proof of bodily harm. This is all a legal analysis. So what's wrong with that as a legal analysis?
Because that renders the arm squeezer a super felon under the ACCA.
So what?
I don't think that's what the statute was designed to accomplish. I think the statute was designed to create harsher sentences for the worst of the worst. And the legislative history tells us that. We put that in our brief. I'll give you another example. In re Angelique E., another case we cite in our brief, is the case where the Illinois Appellate Court held that a simple battery is not a forcible felony under the Illinois Criminal Code, which a forcible felony triggers all sorts of sentence enhancements. Angelique E. was a teenage girl being removed from a public pool who didn't want to leave that day and got into a scuffle with a police officer, resulting in a torn pant leg for the officer and an abrasion on his knee. I don't think the ACCA was designed to punish the Angeliques of the world. Under the current status of the law, however, she would be an ACCA armed criminal.
Well, now, your theory has to be under the current status of the Seventh Circuit's law, because I thought your point was that Johnson was calling for more violence than that.
Correct. That is my position.
Now, I don't see why. I mean, you emphasize a lot the forcible felony provision of Illinois law, but I don't see why that really matters that much. Maybe it's a convenient way that the state of Illinois has defined crimes that are relatively more violent. Lots of other states may not have that distinction. It strikes me as perhaps incidental.
Well, I think they've drawn a distinction between bodily harm and great bodily harm, and my suggestion would be that a more appropriate consideration in determining whether or not conduct satisfies the ACCA is look to the great bodily harm definition.
Nothing in Johnson requires that.
That's correct.
So I think you should spend just a minute talking about some of the preliminary points that the government has raised in its brief, such as the fact that Mr. Hill in his plea agreement waived the right to bring, among other things, collateral attacks.
Well, there is a reservation of rights in the plea agreement for changes to the law under the sentencing guidelines.
Why wouldn't that relate to the part you've now abandoned, the count five challenge, which was the career criminal guidelines enhancement, not count seven, the ACCA?
Well, I think when you read the plea agreement and look at the colloquy in court related to the plea agreement, that it's ambiguous. The colloquy references laws, plural. The sentencing guidelines incorporate the ACCA. And so in that instance, that document should be interpreted favorably to Hill. Certainly, if the government wanted to be more specific in the document they drafted, they could have.
So are you still arguing, I think, in your reply brief that they've waived this point anyway?
Yes.
Or forfeited it, I should say?
Yes, this is the first time it's been raised.
Even not in the district court?
Correct.
Okay. And what about the propriety of Section 2241 for this particular theory? 2241 is a very narrow, if in cases to which 2255 could apply, the Supreme Court has, I think, made it very clear 2241 is supposed to be a narrow escape, and I'm not sure this meets all of the Davenport criteria.
Well, in a nutshell, 2241 allows for a petitioner to seek relief in the event there is a subsequent Supreme Court decision aimed at actual innocence. That can be retroactively applied, which we have in this case with Johnson.
This isn't an actual innocence argument.
This isn't
really
a
sentencing argument. This is his prior convictions and their applicability for sentence enhancement purposes. It doesn't have anything to do with the legality of the conviction.
But with regard to that point, the Navarez decision of this court held that to the extent the defendant is miscategorized under a sentencing guideline as an armed career offender, it is an issue of mischaracterization of justice and actual innocence.
But the facts in Navarez, if I'm remembering them correctly, allowed for the possibility of an unlawful sentence, that is, a sentence longer than what would otherwise have been possible, whereas in Mr. Hill's case, that's not true. I mean, I'm not raising the government's concurrent sentence argument so much as saying that the sentence that he received was within the lawful possible range no matter what. So I don't know. I invite you to think about whether Navarez applies to that kind of situation.
Yes,
sir. If you want to save a minute for rebuttal, that's fine with me as well.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Rotker.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Michael Rotker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the respondent appellee, Robert Werlinger, the warden. Say that five times fast. Let me begin on some of the procedural points. Your Honor asked my opponent about the waiver. To be clear, we did not assert the waiver in the district court. In our view, the proper way to view this is that we forfeited the waiver. It's not a conscious relinquishment of the waiver. We simply didn't invoke it.
And I'm quite sure it wasn't a conscious relinquishment, but
it certainly wasn't. And
I will remind you, though, that the government is an aggressive arguer of waiver and forfeiture when the shoe was on the other foot. And it does seem to me that had you raised this in a timely manner, the entire history of this litigation, which has been complex, would have been different, and it may be too late in the day.
I agree, Your Honor, and certainly I don't want to make excuses. The facts are what the facts are, but just so the Court is aware, as of 2241, this litigation was brought in Wisconsin. The original conviction was from Illinois.
There are
often issues with the documents, and I believe that that's why it wasn't raised. But again, for purposes of affirming the judgment, we've cited the Court to Schmidt another Seventh Circuit precedent that allows the court to overlook our inadvertent failure to raise it. I just want to be clear on the terminology. We didn't waive the waiver. We did forfeit or fail to assert in a timely manner. In terms of the other procedural issues, there's the 2241 question, which strikes near and dear to my heart since I did argue Narvaez and I've argued a lot of these cases, and I just want to try to clarify a couple of points. It is certainly true the Davenport case is obviously this court's seminal decision on when 2241 relief is available. One question that was raised, though, is that this is not a claim of actual innocence. It's a sentencing claim. I want the court to hopefully understand what we tried to lay out in our brief, which is Davenport was a Bailey case, and it was a situation where the conviction itself was invalid. And that's why the court, I think, with respect, was focusing on whether there had been a conviction for a non-existent offense.
Well, Bowsley had come along, sure.
That's right. I mean, but this was pre-Bowsley-Boosley. But I think Davenport was correct in terms of the way it analyzed the issue. And I think the flaw with the kind of Bailey situation is it's a separation of powers problem. We can't have people in jail for committing a crime, passive possession of a firearm, when we later find out that Congress didn't make that a crime. I mean, that's a basic principle that dates back to the founding and Chief Justice Marshall's opinions. There are no common law federal crimes.
We've taken the next step and said if there is an unlawful sentence not authorized, that is it's enough like putting somebody in prison for something that isn't a crime that it's cognizable. I'm not sure this is that case, though, which is why I raised what I did.
Sure, and I appreciate that. And I do think that Narvaez, Your Honor, is correct in summarizing the holding, but the wrinkle, there are a couple of wrinkles. First of all, Narvaez was not a 2241. It was an initial collateral attack under 2255, and the statute specifically provides for remedies for unlawful sentences. This is a 2241. We're further down the chain. It's a successive collateral attack, if you will, not an initial one.
But Congress could have put 2241 in AEDPA, and it didn't.
No, that's right.
So
that's right.
I'm not sure why that matters.
Well, what we're trying to say is that we acknowledge the holding of Narvaez, but I think this case, in other words, the government has conceded that in an Armed Career Criminal Act case where the defendant's predicates are no longer qualifying, and he was sentenced above the 10-year maximum that we now know applies, we believe that is the analog to an actual innocence conviction in the following sense. You have the same separation of powers problem. A district court can impose any sentence within the range, and if he's not an ACCA, then it would be 0 to 10. But if the court gave him more than 10, that's exceeding the court's statutory authority. That's the same separation of powers problem on the sentencing side that Bailey presents on the conviction side. Now, that's all by way of background, but I don't think the court needs to reach any of those issues here, because one other important distinction between Narvaez and this case, there was no dispute that Mr. Narvaez's prior convictions were invalid. Here, that is the very issue that's in dispute, and we think the district court was absolutely correct in saying, in light of this court's three precedents, that there was no error here. So that's another reason why the court doesn't need to wade into all this, but we want the court to understand we're not saying as a categorical matter that the fact that this is a sentencing claim means that it can never be brought under 2241. Our position in this court's case in Sperberg versus Marbury set forth that position very clearly. We just don't think this case implicates that concern.
But that's just in a sense because of your view on the merits of this 1993 battery in a public place.
It's partly in view of the merits. It's partly in view of the fact that we also don't think he can even get there. We don't think he's shown that 2255 was inadequate, which, of course, is the threshold gate that he has to get through. There's nothing that prevented, nothing structural in 2255 itself that prevented Mr. Hill from raising these arguments in a 2255 motion. Now, he waived his rights. But
wasn't he pro se at the time he filed his first? I mean, it may not matter, but he filed that first 2255 pro se.
I believe that's right. But regardless,
unaware that he was blowing it for a lot of.
That's true, but this happens a lot. I mean, it does happen a lot, and that's the point is he could have raised these arguments about what violent force is required earlier. Let's contrast that with the Bailey situation. In Bailey, the prisoner there was Mr. I think it was Nichols. There were two defendants, but the co-defendant. He had already exhausted his first 2255 at the time Bailey came down. He wanted to get relief because he said, hey, I'm in jail for something that Congress hasn't made a crime, and I can't get a second 2255 because I'm relying on a statutory decision, and second 2255s aren't available. He said, let me go to habeas corpus because the statute itself is preventing me from getting relief from this fundamental defect. And we can all agree, I think, that that is the kind of quintessential example of a fundamental error. That's not the case here. There's nothing in 2255 that prevented Mr. Hill. He's not on similar footing to the individual in Mr. Davenport. It's not inadequate. The district court didn't even have to get to the merits. It could have thrown it out on that ground. Now, if the court has further questions on 2241, I'll be happy to address them. The other point I just want to make procedurally is the concurrent sentence doctrine, because I think that is the pink elephant here. If ever there were a case, respectfully, for the court to apply the concurrent sentencing doctrine, I think this is it.
But, you know, it's not been applied very much in recent years, and I think it's because we do understand that district courts have sentencing discretion, and it's entirely possible under these circumstances that the package as a whole would not change if there were a change in this part in count seven. But we don't know that. Sometimes district judges, we had a lot of Palladino remands,
sure,
which you may or may not have followed.
Quite familiar with
them,
yes.
Of Booker. And sometimes the district judges wanted to change it, and sometimes they didn't. And frankly, I don't think we knew which was which.
Well, that's right. This was also a pre-Booker sentence, though. And I think it's what's one thing that's important, a couple of things that are important to emphasize about the particular facts. And let me just say also, the court may not have applied the doctrine very much, but it has applied it in Breaux and Griffin, two cases that are cited. And Griffin was an FSA case cited a year or two ago that cited Breaux, which in turn relied on the old case in Kimberlin. I think the doctrine is alive and well in this circuit, and I think it is specifically applicable in this type of situation. And let me try to explain why. In the old days, the concurrent sentence doctrine was an effort to avoid considering a defendant's challenge to a conviction when he had other convictions for which concurrent sentences were imposed. And, of course, we know from Ray that the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And the reason why is that the conviction itself carries collateral consequences. The special assessment is the prime example. So you can't avoid considering a challenge to a conviction.
But this is a sentencing case.
Exactly.
But the whole sentencing package is a long one for Mr. Hill.
Well,
you'll agree.
It is a long one. But
and it might not have been quite as long if he hadn't been seen as such an aggravated person.
Well, respectfully, I disagree. And I think if you go back and look at the pre-sentence report, what you'll see is that his career offender status, which is not challenged, was based on the two priors, and it made him level 34, category 6. If you look at his ACCA designation, it made him level 34, category 6. It's not going to change. He had the same range on both, and the career offender status is not disputed. So, I mean, this is the classic case that Kimberlin...
Of course, guidelines are guidelines at this point. Level 34...
I think it's 188 to 235, if my memory serves me.
Well, that would be all the way down to 31.
He got a three-level reduction. That's what it was. He got an acceptance. So it was 31-6.
Right. If it's a 31-6, it's 188 to 235.
Right.
And there's flexibility in there, and there's flexibility to change. So I just think that... the concept of the sentencing package is the one that makes it difficult to say, oh, it never would make any difference.
Well, I
just sentencing, and I do understand the difference, obviously, between convictions and sentencing.
Right, and that's the one distinction. The other distinction I would just emphasize, we're not looking at whether he was sentenced today under advisory guidelines. These were mandatory guidelines back then. The district court didn't have the kind of discretion, the sentencing package and all that. I mean, if you took the ACCA sentence and the ACCA conviction out of this case, he's facing the exact same range, and it's not in dispute because...
That's an interesting question. Suppose we did think he needed resentencing.
Right.
I can't imagine that resentencing would take place under a now struck down by the Supreme Court mandatory guideline
Correct.
Regime.
It would be a resentencing under advisory guidelines.
Exactly. So,
but only... I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I think that may also be something to take into account with your argument.
Respectfully, though, it would only be on count 7. It's only on the ACCA count. The career offender count, that's exactly why I think the concurrent sentence doctrine applies. The career offender conviction is not challenged. That's a drug conviction. The career offender sentence... 216 months is not challenged, and the two priors that support the career offender status are not challenged. So if there were a remand, and we think the court should not remand for lots of reasons, we would think that it would be a limited remand simply on count 7. I agree with Your Honor that you would not resentence under mandatory guidelines. It would be under advisory guidelines. But that's not going to affect the number of days that he's going to spend in jail is going to be exactly, the number of months is going to be exactly the same because of the unchallenged conviction and sentence on count 5. And that's exactly why we think this... I started off by saying if there ever there were a case, and I think this is it, nothing's in dispute about the prior 216-month sentence. If the court has any further questions about any of these matters, I'm happy to address them. But other than that, the court has a number of grounds on which it can affirm the judgment, and we respectfully ask the court to do so. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Steinke? So I actually have a question for you, which is whether you have preserved somehow any request for a general remand on sentencing that would include a look at the whole sentencing package, or whether Mr. Rodker is correct that the only thing that could happen would be a fairly nominal change in count 7.
Frankly, I think it's the latter, Your Honor. But guidelines are guidelines, and they are discretionary, and the burden is not on Mr. Hill to prove the unprovable, and that is that he can jump inside the sentencing court's mind and explain exactly why it would be different. On that point, I just wanted to leave you with a quote from the Navarez case, wherein the court said, "The government is correct that Mr. Navarez does not have an absolute right to a lower sentence. Nevertheless, he does have an absolute right not to stand before the court as a career offender when the law does not impose that label on him." And I think that's our point on that case.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not?
That's right, Your Honor.
The court very much appreciates your help with this case. It's a very complicated one, and that of your firm. I'm sure it took a lot of time. And thank you as well to the government.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.